You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So, is it spoiled rich kid or religious wackadoodle? We'll get into that in just a second. What's up with Mitt Romney? Also, do you have a constitutional right to an insanity defense? We're going to get into that in our second hour. And a big stack of stuff that's going on in the news right now. I want to start, though, with this. I just find this fascinating. You know, we know, and by the way, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. This is the Tom Hartman Program, if you hadn't noticed. And just a couple of things. Mitt Romney, of course, went to the United Kingdom and immediately put his foot in his mouth in a way that was obvious to the world. I mean, one of his advisors said that this was the, this was all about his Anglo-Saxon heritage. And the Anglo-Saxon appreciation tour is what I was calling it last week. Anglo-Saxon, of course, being an old term that means blonde people. And, you know, that word was used before in kind of the context of master race. And then he managed to insult the city of London, and he insulted the prime minister, and he insulted the mayor. And so Boris Johnson, I think his name is, the mayor of London, came out and just, you know, went ballistic on him. And David Cameron, the prime minister, said, oh, yeah, you running in Olympics in the middle of nowhere, it's no big deal. But this is a big, vibrant city, one of the biggest in the world. So the question in my mind was, what kind of damage is he going to do when he goes to Israel? And now we know. And I find this just fascinating. The story that's probably getting the most press. Well, actually, the two stories that are getting the most press are Romney dissing the Palestinians and Romney praising the Israeli national healthcare system, which is based on nonprofit HMOs and an individual mandate. It's a universal healthcare system. So, and there's a there, by the way, in these. But the one that's not getting a lot of coverage, in fact, it's getting very, very little coverage. I'm astounded by how little coverage it's gotten. Is Romney comparing Israel and the travel of Moses from the Nile, where there was water and they knew it was safe, out into the desert where there was nothing? And to quote Romney, they had to rely on themselves. Plays into his meme of, you know, I'm rich because I'm a self-made man. And God, I'm rich because I'm a self-made man and I'm going to have my own planet when I die. You know, that kind of stuff, right? Comparing, and I think, frankly, that what he was doing is he was comparing that with the journey of Brigham Young from, what was it, Indiana, I think, where Joseph Smith got killed? Maybe it was Illinois. It was somewhere in the Midwest. Joseph Smith had led his merry band of polygamists out of, as I recall, New York State into the central Midwest. And then he got murdered by a couple of local guys who were upset that he was trying to hustle off their wives or their preteen daughters. And so he ended, you know, so Brigham Young ended up taking the rest of the merry band out to Salt Lake City, which is the desert. And so in my mind, and this is, you know, by the way, not to knock Mormons or Mormonism, every religion has its, shall we say, dicey history. I mean, go back and read the story of one of the direct descendants of Jesus, the story of Lot. If you really want to be scratching your head at the end of a little bit of Bible reading. But anyhow, here's Romney speaking at a breakfast to 40 very rich donors in Israel. Raised a lot of money there, by the way. He says, I was thinking this morning as I prepared to come into this room of a discussion I had across the country in the United States about my perceptions about differences between countries. He went on to talk about the difference between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. He said this is a dramatic, stark difference in economic vitality. And that part of his speech is the part where it looks like he's trashing the Palestinians, or he's defining Israel and therefore presumably Jewish people who live there as literally the chosen people, something that I think even most modern Jews would disavow, because every religion thinks they're the chosen ones, right? They're, you know, we're God's special people. Just, you know, ask Jimmy Swaggart, right? Ask some evangelist, you know, pick your religion. So anyhow, Mitt says, as you come here and you see the GDP per capita, for instance, in Israel, which is around $21,000, and compare that with the GDP per capita just across the areas managed by the Palestinian Authority, which is more like $10,000 per capita. Actually, it's more like $1,700. It's much, much lower. Anyhow, he says, you notice such a dramatically stark difference in economic vitality. And as I come here and I look out over this city and consider the accomplishments of the people of this nation, I recognize the power of at least culture and a few other things, including the hand of providence. Now, many Palestinian leaders are saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we've got a problem because we're in occupied territory, one. And two, are you saying that those people are chosen by God and we're not? Is that really what you're trying to say, that we've, you know, God dissed us? I mean, we went through this with Rachel and Hagar, wasn't it? If I'm remembering my biblical history right. Probably not, but in any case. But here's where it gets really interesting. It's where he's talking about Mormons. He says, one, I recognize the hand of providence in selecting this place. I'm told in a Sunday school class I attended, I think my son Tag was teaching the class. He's not here. I look around to see. Of course, he's not here. He was in London. He taught a class, I'm quoting Romney here, he taught a class in which he was describing the concern on the part of some of the Jews that left Egypt to come to the Promised Land, that in the Promised Land was down the River Nile that would provide the essential water they'd enjoyed in Egypt. Now, that's a very badly constructed sentence. What he's trying to say is they're leaving their source of water. He said they came here recognizing that they must be relied upon themselves and the arm of God to provide rain from the sky. And this, therefore, represented a sign of faith and a show of faith to come here. That this is a people that has long recognized the purpose in this place and in their lives that is greater than themselves and their own particular interests. Which is, you know, very, very nice language. And to a large extent, there's you know, a fair amount of truth in that. You know, people stepping out and saying no to the Pharaoh and going off into the desert and taking horrible chances and people taking horrible chances, you know, even today to go live in Israel. But the context, I think basically what he was saying is, you know, us Mormons are just like you Jews. Or, you know, vice versa. The Mormons do teach that Jesus did come to North America and appeared before the Native Americans the day that he was crucified, gathered 12 Native American disciples, trained them, you know, left prophecies. I mean, that's all in the Book of Mormon. And then, of course, the Mormons went, across the country and into the desert, into Salt Lake City. Nothing there. A lake you can't even drink. Right? I just find it fascinating. And the whole disconnect between Mitt Romney as somebody who understands basically, you know, the subtleties of international politics. I mean, if you're ever going to be the president and you want to try and reconcile peace between Israel and the Palestinians, you don't start out by saying that the Israelis are the chosen people and they're prosperous because God loves them, providence. And the Palestinians are not because he doesn't. You don't start out that way.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Nor do you have your company taking down American jobs and sending them overseas. We're going to get to that right after this.
And when asked about the jobs destroyed, you definitely took a pass and you just said you proud of your money, proud of your money, and you're so vain. You
You think you can avoid all your taxes?
Oh, yeah.
You think you can avoid all your taxes, taxes, taxes.
And not only that, you can lay off the little people. Cheryl Randecker is with us, an employee at Sensata Technologies. Am I pronouncing that right, Cheryl?
Yes, you are.
And your name as well?
Yes, you are.
Okay.
You're doing great.
Okay, so far so good. And Sensata Technologies, I understand the Governor Pat Quinn of Illinois is visiting Freeport. Y'all are in Freeport, Illinois, and that the City Council has passed unanimously a resolution about this issue. Tell us what's going on.
Okay, Governor Quinn was in town last Thursday.
Oh, it was last Thursday. My apologies. I have an old news story.
That's okay. And with the City Council, we're asking Mitt Romney to come along with President Obama to have a debate, just like the Lincoln-Douglas debate here in the city of Freeport was like 150-some years ago.
Right.
And we want them to debate bringing the jobs back to America and keeping the jobs here in America.
Now, my understanding is Sensata Technologies, the company for whom you work, has been acquired by Mitt Romney's company, Bain Capital. He no longer runs it, but he still owns a lot of stock in it, and he founded this company. That this company acquired the company for whom you work, and you have been, or you and some of your coworkers have been required to actually train the people from China who are going to replace you, and they're going to move the manufacturing offshore. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
When did you learn of this?
Actually, some have just went back from here. We just got done training people for like 3 months, and now they are in the process of starting to move the machines out of the plant.
You just got done training people from where?
China. We also trained some from Mexico in another area that of the factory that's been moving. That line will be moved to Mexico and not to China.
So Bain Capital is breaking your company in two and sending part of it to Mexico and part of it to China. Is that right?
That's pretty much nuts and bolts of it.
And asking the employees of Sensata Technologies to train their replacements. This is mind-boggling. And the Freeport City Council passed a resolution 8-0, unanimous, asking Mitt Romney to come visit and keep the jobs in town. Governor Quinn came to town and raised the issue. Have you all heard from Mitt Romney?
No, we haven't. The last we heard that he's not aware of any of this, and I find that hard to believe because I don't think you can miss it, especially if you're running for president office, you know. You kind of want to stay on top of things.
You would think, definitely. And what does Sensata Technologies make? What do you do?
Yeah, automotive parts for the cars that go into our engines, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real small sensor. Mm-hmm. That gets molded and over-molded again.
Hmm.
And then Chrysler and GM both use it at this point.
And soon the Chrysler and GM sensors will be made in China and Mexico.
That's correct.
First of all, is this a union shop or a non-union shop?
No, it's a non-union shop. So everything that we have done has been just us workers organizing and trying to do the right thing by keeping the jobs in the U.S. It came about by the Bring the Jobs Home Act, the bill that kind of didn't get too far in Washington.
Well, it passed the House of Representatives, as I recall. It got stopped by Republicans in the Senate.
Right. So, and that's actually how this all came to the forefront. And then we found out that Sensata was owned by Bain Capital. So that's kind of where we're at. And everybody back here has been devastated. I mean, my daughter left a four-year college to come home to try to help save money.
Right.
So she's going to it'll slow her learning experiences down.
What is your situation? What are you facing?
I myself will probably end up going back to school because I'm too young to retire, and I'm a single parent, and I'm just trying to make life go on.
Wow. It's going to be a tough one.
At my age, it's going to be a tough one going back to school.
Are you going to have to get loans to do that?
Actually, that is one thing that is pretty good, with the exception they have to tell us we've been approved for the TAA program, which is a federal program.
Right.
But each state they're allowed to run it how they see fit.
Mm-hmm.
And if that same degree isn't approved that you want to go to school for, then you need to find something else.
Right.
So they're kind of dictating even though they're taking our jobs, they're telling us what we can and can't do then.
Wow. Wow, remarkable. Clearly the community is on your side.
Clearly,
the governor's ear has been perked up by this. Is there any, it says in my notes here that there's not a website for what you're doing other than the company's website, which, obviously is not interested
in
this.
We have our own little website. It's on Facebook, actually. Save Our Jobs.
Save Our Jobs.
Jobs on Facebook. And then the other one, they can sign a petition, is signon.org.
Okay.
/sign/Mitt/Romney/stop/shipping. And that'll take you right to the petition that we're trying to get people to sign to save these jobs.
Okay.
And they could also send a message to him on Twitter at Mitt Romney.
Okay. Great.
So that's some ways that we can try to put some pressure on.
We
know that he says he doesn't own the company, but when you've got that much stock involved and you're getting that much income.
He made $20 million bucks last year just sitting on his butt around the pool waiting for the dividend checks from Bain Capital to arrive.
We're back here, and we didn't even get a raise this year. So it's just kind of hard to swallow when you've got that kind of money. And I just read an article in Vanity Fair as well, and it's really tough to swallow when you see all of this happening.
Yeah,
and
it's amazing.
This isn't the first time, by the way, because Honeywell is here in town, and that's who they bought the automotive from.
Amazing.
And we also, this is twice in 2 years that I've lost my job to China.
Oh, my. Cheryl Randecker, thank you so much for being with us, Cheryl.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Go to Facebook and check out Save Our Jobs. And you can, just Google this thing, too. What's going on with Sensata Technologies. We'll be back.
Well, we're living here in Allentown. And they're closing all the factories down. Out in Bethlehem, they're killing time. Filling out forms, standing in line.
Yeah, Bain Capital gets into the game, and the workers lose. Mitt Romney makes a lot of money, though. And with regard to my little riff on Mitt going to Israel and comparing, in my mind, he's talking about a Bible class his son taught, which is obviously about Mormonism. Obviously in the Mormon church, anyway. About, people going out into the desert and the nobility of the early Jews who did that. I just want to say for the record, if anybody listening thought that what I was doing or saying was condemning, because there's this kind of knee-jerk response in this country in particular. Oddly, I've spent a fair amount of time in Israel and other parts of the Middle East, but especially in Israel. And there is a vibrant debate there about, for example, what's going on with the Palestinians. Should we expand the settlement? Should we decrease the settlement? Should we be turning some of the land back to them? Should the wall be built? Should the wall not be built? By and large, the more hardline folks have been winning that debate. And in part because the Palestinians have not followed the advice of those who have suggested over the years that, although they have been actually for some years now, but early on, we're not following the advice of, let's say, Gandhi. But then arguably neither were the Israelis. I mean, it is an incredibly complicated and messy situation that goes back millennia, thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And so speaking as somebody who supports Israel's right to exist and personally, I think Israel's a really great country, and I would like to see Palestine become a really great country. I don't think the interests of Israel are well served when American politicians use Israel as, in a jingoistic way. When they go off and say, oh yeah, you guys are here and the way you are and everything, you've got all the prosperity you do because divine providence. God loves you more than anybody else. I don't think saying, I mean, he might say that privately, but I don't think saying that out loud, I mean, he might believe that privately, but I don't think saying that out loud, in fact, I don't think saying that out loud advances the cause of Israel. In fact, I think it retards, I think it hurts the cause of Israel. And I think it also speaks to this notion within Mormonism that Mormons are the chosen people on the North American continent, that they're uniquely different from all the rest of us. The first families, you know, Romney tracks back to one of the very first families, and there's this kind of club of the first families. I mean, Willard Mitt Romney was named after J.W. Marriott. Middle name was Willard. And another one of the first families. I mean, there's some very wealthy and powerful people who have come out of those first families to occupy and settle Salt Lake City. Very successful people. God bless them for it. I mean, I'm not criticizing that per se. What I'm saying is that there is, for some people who are very successful and wealthy, a belief that they did it themselves without anybody's help, and that not only did they do it themselves because they're really smart and really hardworking, and generally they are, but also because God loves them or picked them out. It's the old thing, you know, you see these all the time on the news, right? The tornado goes through, tears up a community, kills a bunch of people, and some guy stand there in front of the camera, you know, in front of a house where five people died, going, oh, I just made it out. I guess God saved me. Well, what about the other five people? So, anyway, and then Romney comes out and says, and Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Well, you know, there's a lot of Israelis who would like that. But the problem is the United States has not recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Tel Aviv is the capital. It's where our embassy is. The United Nations not only has not recognized Jerusalem, but considers it occupied land, as does the U.S. officially, or at least a large part of Jerusalem. And it's, again, for a presidential candidate to be stepping into things that are going to inflame a process that needs to be tamped down, in my opinion, is not in the best interest of Israel or Palestine or the United States, probably more, you know, apropos, more to the point. Jason in Chicago. Hey, Jason, what's up?
And yeah.
Jason?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, you're on
here.
The air.
I'm here.
Okay, what's up?
I'm sorry, Tom. Hey, Tom, you know, I'm a truck driver, and I'm kind of associated with some products, you know. I make pickups and deliveries over to that facility, and no longer, basically. And, you know, and the Mitt Romneys of the world are just ripping off America, and it's time that we need to wake up and realize that they're stealing from column A and putting in column A. And meanwhile, column W and column P are growing exponentially, and column W is the waste of both human and natural resources. Column P is the pollution that it creates on top of it. And, you know, and the column A is healthy column. It's property tax, vendor payments, it's social security.
I got it, Jason. Jason, I'm sorry to cut you off, but your phone is really breaking up. It's very hard to understand what you're saying, but I got it clearly. You're a truck driver. You are no longer going to be picking up there. That organization is lost to the community, the prosperity from it, the taxes from it, the income to the workers, all those other things. Very, very well said. Thank you, Jason, for weighing in. Denise in New York City. Denise, you're going to vote for pro-Israel Romney. Do I have that right? Denise? Apparently, Denise is not there. Stanley in West Point, Mississippi. Hey, Stanley, what's up? No Stanley. All right. Larry in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Larry, you're on the air.
Boy, you're having some phone problems there.
I'm not sure if it's that or if people just don't realize. The last two were TV callers, and the time delay on radio is only about 7 seconds. Time delay on TV is almost a minute, so... if people are not listening to their telephones, they miss things badly. Anyhow, what's up, Larry?
Okay, a few things. I want to first talk about what Romney said about the culture of Israel and why they're doing so well. It should be known that Dan Senior, wrote a book that's called Startup Nation. He's on Romney's staff. And what Startup Nation said, it spoke about why Israel has many companies on the NASDAQ, why it's been growing as much as it has. And it talks about the culture that is in Israel where people take risks and where the people in Israel don't, even if they have somebody that owns the factory, they're not afraid to speak out and they're aggressive in that area. That is what Romney is talking about. It's a cultural difference. And what's also has not been widely.
But you know what provides that, Larry, is that anybody can start a business in Israel because, well, there's a fair amount of venture capital and government capital available for business startups, which is not so much the case anymore in the United States. But more importantly, everybody in the country has health insurance. People are not afraid to leave their employers.
Wait a minute. That you're tying two issues together, and I'm not going to talk about the health insurance. What happens in
I'm telling you, when we have national health care in the United States, you're going to see a renewal of entrepreneurialism in this country because people who have great ideas and would love to get out and start them are afraid to do so because they're afraid to lose the insurance for themselves, their families right now.
Okay. Everybody agrees there should be some reform, and I don't want to stick on that subject. That's not what the Startup Nation says, and you ought to read it. You're a smart guy. I don't agree with you on anything, but you are better than most of them out there. But you said a few things that are just plainly incorrect, and it's been said that it is. You shouldn't be talking about Romney and Bain Capital and outsourcing. It's ridiculous to even bring it up. The fact is that his only responsibility as the person who ran Bain Capital was to make profit. He did nothing illegal, nothing unethical. If you feel it is, then go talk to your congressman and change it. But his fiduciary responsibility was to make profit. If he didn't, then everybody who invested with him would have the right to go sue him. His job was not to create jobs. And to say in the same breath and not mention the fact that Obama...
Then he shouldn't be in business. Then he shouldn't be in business. We shouldn't have businesses. There are a lot of ethical business people in this country who don't buy up companies just looking to lay people off. This guy went into business. He went into companies knowing that he was going to destroy the lives of Americans, knowing it. And and decided that he could look himself in the mirror every morning knowing that he'd put $300-500 million in his back pocket, destroying the lives of Americans. You may think that that's a noble thing. You may think that's a marvelous thing. I consider that to be a terrible character flaw. He started a company based on a business model that had to do with gaming the tax system, gaming the tax code, knowing that with this so-called carried interest income that he would pay a maximum of 15% income tax, that by stripping these companies down and loading them with debt, something that would have been illegal before the Reagan administration, illegal. That by doing this, he could make a ton of money and destroy a lot of jobs in America. You can defend him all day long and say, gee, what he did was legal. In my opinion, that doesn't make it right, and it certainly doesn't make him qualified to be president.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, I can show you tobacco executives who are responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans every year, and everything they do is legal. You want them as president? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Caleb in Portland. Hey, Caleb, what's up?
Hey, you know, well, first of all, I gave to Real TV last year. I will do it again, and thank you so much for promoting that group. What a wonderful group that is.
Yeah.
You know, if making money legally was the only requirement to be president of the United States, making a lot of money, why don't we just enroll the last megabucks winners? I mean, what the heck? You know, he was born with a silver spoon somewhere in a minute, and he made millions after that. But he's not only a megabucks person doesn't know they're going to rip other people off. I mean, I think megabucks winners are a hell of a lot more moral than Mitt.
Yeah, they just bought a lottery ticket with a pack of cigarettes at the 7-Eleven.
But they're not putting people out of work.
That's right. In fact, you know, maybe they didn't buy a pack of cigarettes. Let's say they're buying the gum or the candy or whatever actually put people to work. So they're actually creating jobs. Maybe we should just have a lottery in the United States rather than an election.
Rich people, yeah.
A lottery. Everybody, you know, you can buy a ticket for a dollar. You can buy as many tickets as you want, and whoever wins gets $20 million and becomes president.
But I'm not sure you want Adelson as president, but that's
no. They get the $20 million, but yeah, actually, yeah, he could buy more lottery tickets. So we're back to the original problem. Thanks a lot, Caleb. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. June in Maywood, Illinois, and listening to WCPT. Hey, June, what's up?
First off, Tom, thanks for the education. And thanks for being cool and calm. But to the lady who trained all these people to take her job, if I'm not mistaken, back when the first NAFTA was signed between Canada and the United States, there
and
was
Mexico.
An agreement that jobs that were taken out of the country, the people would be retrained.
That's right.
And
that was passed during the Clinton administration.
Place or not, but and it was, I know it was reinforced when they added Mexico,
yeah,
but I can't remember what
that was passed during the Clinton administration. That was the piece of legislation she referenced. I'm sorry, I don't recall the name of it. And it does provide for training. You have to be trained, though, in an area that is consistent with either what the community needs or what your previous job was, you know, a step up from or something like that. And you're absolutely right. And that's still out there. And so that's the one, you know, silver lining, I suppose, is that she can get some job training without it costing a whole lot of money. But if she goes to one of these for-profit schools, another shocking thing. And thank you for the call, June. I appreciate it.
And for Mitt.
Yes.
I wonder if he knows what the Balfour Treaty is all about.
Yeah, I doubt it. I very seriously doubt it. And so anyway, I won't go down that road. I'm just... David in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just, you know,
thanks for listening to AM 950.
Yep, with Mitt's trip overseas, you know, it was to, expose his or let us get some insight into his foreign policy. And, you know, basically he's supporting a preemptive strike. He didn't come out and actually say that against Iran. And
by Israel.
This is,
in my opinion, the worst thing that could happen. I mean, if Israel and the United States got together and they said, okay, we've got to do something about Iran that involves dropping, you know, bunker buster bombs on them or something like that, it should be, which I totally disagree with and I think would be a horrible thing. It would consolidate all the opposition in Iran. It would inflame the Middle East. It would be a disaster. But all that said, if it was going to be done, it should not be done by Israel. It should be done by us, because if it's done by Israel, it puts them in the crosshairs of all their neighbors, and that's not good for Israel.
Yeah, and I have one other point here, Tom. You know, remember in 08, John McCain's advisors went over to Georgia, and there was the little conflict of between Georgia and Russia, you know, and that happened in August. So don't be surprised if we have a preemptive attack, you know, to make Obama look bad, or that could be the October surprise in August again, Tom.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, go back and look at the history of that. Karl Rove was supposed to testify before Congress. He had been subpoenaed by Nancy Pelosi. This is what she said she could have put him in jail for. He didn't show up. This was about the Valerie Plame outing. He didn't show up. Why? Because he was in Yalta. What was he doing in Yalta? He was meeting with Mikhail Saakashvili, who was the president of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. And a couple of weeks after Karl Rove met with Saakashvili, Saakashvili attacks South Ossetia and Abkhazia is the other country. These two little countries on the northern border, which are in dispute between them and Russia, and so immediately Russia comes in and just squashes them like a bug. And then a month later, John McCain pushes through a billion dollars, as a gift to Saakashvili. No strings attached. Here, have $1 billion. Thanks for doing this. And McCain had been trumpeting this. I mean, this actually got McCain a bounce in the polls against Obama for about a 2-week period during the time of this conflict, because McCain was the cold warrior who's going to take on Russia. And Obama, you know, was a community organizer, right? What does he know? And I absolutely agree with you. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see another October surprise like that. Check it out. Byron in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Byron, what's on your mind?
Hey, I was just calling in regards to Mitt Romney and that prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's not the whole prophecy. There's two other prophecies that come before.
Are you a Mormon?
The LDS president. There's supposed to be a civil war. And then an invasion. So, I mean, that the LDS president's like 20, 30, 40 years off, you know, and
Mitt Romney, of course, I don't believe he's Mormon at all. I think he found a good place to hide.
Are you a Mormon, sir?
Just like McCain.
Hey, Byron?
And,
Byron, Byron, are you a member of the Latter-day Saints Church?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
So, I've been my whole life.
Okay. In that case, keep going. You know, I just, you know, Mormon bashing by non-Mormons is something that I'm uncomfortable with. But if you're a Mormon, and it doesn't sound like you're bashing, why do you think Mitt Romney is not a member of the church?
Because I think he's found a good place to hide, and I think his father thought it was a good place to hide, too. I think that most of these politicians and business owners, you know, I think they have their religion of their own. And I think that they know that. I think that, you know, they know exactly what they're doing. And it's totally counterintuitive. I mean, listen to John Huntsman, you know, or, I mean, she's not John Huntsman, but McCain or any of them. It's just totally not in correlation with what the prophets say.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Byron, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for the Mormon insight. Coming up next, John Manuelian is going to be with us, libertarian criminal defense and civil rights attorney. Should the insanity defense, particularly given what just happened in Aurora, Colorado, be ruled illegal?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, let's track down the Eighth Amendment here. There we go. VIII. Excessive bail shall not be required. Welcome back to the program, by the way. Nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. That's it. It's one sentence. So what would be a cruel or unusual punishment? If a person genuinely doesn't have control of their faculties and they commit a crime, let's say in this case the crime of murder or even the crime of mass murder, as in the case of this fellow in Colorado whose name I don't like to say on the radio, and he were to be insane, should we be considering the death penalty or prosecuting him, sending him to prison? And on the other hand, who but an insane person would do something like that? I mean, this is a genuine conundrum, I think, for American society and for societies, you know, for civilized societies all over the world. What is the difference between insanity and evil? What is the difference between insanity and broken? What is the difference between insanity and damaged? John Manuelian is with us. He is a libertarian criminal defense and civil rights attorney. Manuelian Law Firm, M-A-N-U-E-L-I-A-N, lawfirm.com is the website. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, is your perspective on this personal, or is it informed by your libertarian views?
That would depend on you, Tom. You tell me. I'll tell you my experience.
Okay.
I've been doing this for 11 years, and I've dealt with the insanity issue several times and competency issues. And when I first started out, I had a very conservative attitude about it. I thought that most of the people that said they were insane were just flat-out lying. And you know what? Some of them were. They were lying, and they were trying to put it over on me to formulate a defense so that I could help them basically get out of jail and try to beat the system. And I can tell you in those kinds of cases, the jury's... jurors are very smart. They see through that.
Sure.
And no expert in the world will be able to erase the common sense of 12 people in the community. But I'll tell you a story. I had a client where she was evading the police. Police pulled her over. She thought she was being chased by Martians. She's been seeing a psychiatrist for many years. She's got schizophrenia. You know what? The DHS didn't care. She said, you know what? I had a schizophrenic in my family, and I don't have sympathy. If you do something, you're responsible for your actions, and she wanted prison time on a 50-something-year-old lady with no, record. It's a case-by-case basis, Tom. I can't tell you flat across the board. I'm against it for it. And for this lady, I thought it was very harsh to send her to prison. She had no record. I think she needed therapy. And thankfully, I got it for her. But there are a lot of people that are in jail and prison that have mental problems, and I do think that in most of those cases, it is cruel and unusual because... if you don't have a record and you did a heinous crime, there's got to be a reason that you did it. And I understand you're saying it's probably evil, but sometimes it's not. And those are the cases that we have to distinguish and put aside.
Well, and evil is even a term that is... John, I don't disagree with you at all on any of this. I don't know if that surprises you or not, but I'm very, very ambivalent about this issue, and I have known people who have committed crimes out of their mental illness, or at least one, and not a major crime, but and I've also known people who are just a little off, and have committed crimes like shoplifting and things that came out of what I think is sort of some sort of neurotic need to be noticed or to be accepted, or fill in the blanks, right? We can psychoanalyze people all day long. The concept of evil, though, is a really tough one because it's kind of semi-biblical. I mean, the modern society, the Enlightenment, the big debate that happened in what year was it? 15, it must have been 1534 when Thomas Hobbes published Leviathan. And he said two things. He kicked off the modern liberal movement and the modern conservative movement. He kicked off the modern liberal movement by saying that it was not right that the king should own everything, including your person, your underwear, your spouse, everything. That was not right. That people should have the right to self-government. In that regard, he kicked off the modern progressive movement, the Enlightenment, which led directly to Thomas Jefferson writing the Declaration of Independence. In a way, quoting Hobbes, not so much. He was more quoting Locke, obviously. But then Hobbes also asserted that humankind, was essentially and foundationally evil, and that we were only good when we fought our true nature, and that therefore, if we looked at Aboriginal or Indigenous people, we would find that it would be a continuous war against all, and that life would be nasty, short, and brutish. And 40 years after that, John Locke came along and said, no, the essential nature of human beings is to be good. And when we're evil, there's a flaw, either a cultural flaw, an individual flaw, or both. And therefore, we can govern ourselves, and we don't need the iron, to quote Hobbes, the iron fist of church or state. Hobbes wanted there to be a government or a church that had the ultimate authority, the iron fist, because he felt that we were evil. And then Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 1680s, with his noble savage idea. And, of course, Locke in his second treatise on government in 1674, wrote about life, liberty, and property, that those were essential rights. Jefferson turned that into life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So this is a debate that's been going on literally since we stopped having feudal, F-E-U-D-A-L, political systems that assumed that the king was divinely inspired and had the right to rule. And I don't know how to define evil. Do you?
Yes, I think I think most people would define evil as something that goes against all human instinct, moral instinct, spiritual instinct.
Okay.
And is an act of violence against another human without any reason. Logical reason.
A discernible reason. I mean, there's always, as you said earlier, there's always a reason. It's just, it may not be obvious to us or discernible.
It's got to be acceptable to the norm of the community. That's going into the fuel systems. There were the norms in different areas where, depending on where you lived, and the norms are established based on the community that you lived in.
Certainly.
And most of the statutes across the country are still like that, such as California.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't disagree. But maybe I should have said, I don't know the origin of evil. I don't disagree with your definition of evil, although I think that it's been more, that word, evil, is more used, typically used as a teleological or a theological argument.
Tom, I could tell you I know what evil is. I've represented murderers. I've looked inside murderers' eyes with no defenses, with what we call ice in their eyes, where their souls are black. You could see it in their eyes.
Yeah.
I've seen it, okay? I've talked to people, and I love defending people, and I'm not saying that all my clients are guilty, but I've represent some heinous people, and I've seen what they've done,
right.
And really there's no explanation for it other than they're lost souls.
And so you're suggesting, if I have this right, John, that the insanity defense should be available to people who are genuinely insane. That is to say that they have a brain disorder, an organic brain disorder that we can identify, like schizophrenia.
Exactly, like schizophrenia, or at least something that could be presented to the jury, because it's a rebuttable presumption, which means you, as the defense attorney, has to convince the jury that this guy has the problems.
Right.
It's clear, convincing evidence.
Or something that can be treated.
And tough. Yeah, and also there's got to be standards. There's got to be a buffer. You can't just have anybody trick the system. And there are high standards, but unfortunately with the Colorado shooting now, everybody's second-guessing whether or not there should be an insanity defense at all.
Yeah. Okay, I'm with you. I think that we should keep the insanity defense. We need to, it seems occasionally that it's abused, but frankly, in order to have it, you have to tolerate a certain amount of abuse. And,
of course.
You know, that's just the cost of it. And doing away with the right because some people abuse it is that's insane. John Manuelian, ManuelianLawFirm.com. John, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
And for your insights. It's a fascinating conversation. We'll continue right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So do you think that this guy in Colorado was insane or evil? And should there be an insanity defense for people who commit these kind of crimes? Defending America from the Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Jim in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm enjoying your discussion with the gentleman on the insanity defense. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I've actually got a case where that's the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And
what have you learned from that?
Somewhat limited in what I can talk about, of course. But just I've been practicing law for almost 30 years, and a lot of people who get in trouble have some level of mental disease or problems.
Right.
It's just so glaringly obvious if we could just develop a healthcare system that treated mental illness as an illness, we'd be able to save a great deal on corrections and probably not a small amount on people like me.
I have seen numbers suggesting that while somewhere between 5 and 10% of the U.S. population, and there are some numbers suggesting it's as high as 25%, but, you know, that's where you get into these kind of fuzzy definitions of what is a mental illness. But, you know, hardcore, about 10% of the U.S. population has a definable and problematic for them mental illness, whether it's something like alcohol addiction or obsessive compulsive disorder or, you know, borderline personality disorder, whatever, some sort of serious personality disorder. That's in the general population. But if you look at the prison population, it's well over 50%.
And well over 50%.
Yeah, and therefore, I totally agree with you. If we were identifying people and treating them for their mental illnesses, particularly the milder or more minor mental illnesses that lead people to things like drug addiction and then bring them into the crosshairs of the criminal justice system, or simply, find themselves in economic straits and don't have the options or abilities to be an entrepreneur in the real world the way Mitt Romney was with a multimillionaire father, and instead, you know, they're living in a very, very poor community, and basically the only thing, and they know how to buy and sell, but the only thing they can buy and sell is pot or coke or something like that. And again, they end up in jail. It seems that so much could be prevented if we were just to have a rational, if we were to view these, you know, drug addiction as an illness and mental illness as an illness and treat it all. And Jim, you said it very well. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Milton in Northampton, Mass. Hey, Milton, what's up?
Oh, it's great to be on your show. You're having such great big thoughts when you're talking about Hobbes and Locke, and I learned a lot from that. I'm a master's level psychotherapist, and I wanted to talk a little bit about evil in terms of the development of psychological theory.
Mm-hmm.
Where it started by looking at what's inside the person, intrapersonal, and gradually grew out to look at interpersonal dynamics, to the point where you get to feminist psychology that starts to say, hey, you can't look at an individual separate from that individual's social environment. There is no distinct self. We use each other for mirrors all the time to find out who we are. And, you know, if we're going to talk about evil, my idea of evil, and, you know, it's a you know, it's an invention, and I'm sure it's common to a lot of other people. But somebody who's cut off from social connection to the point where they can't be reached is going to be able, is beyond all kinds of social control. It's not a matter of telling somebody what to do. It's a matter of him feeling totally divorced.
Right.
And it, you know, it's partly the definition of a psychopath or sociopath. I get it mixed up.
Well, they're interchangeable at a certain level.
Yeah.
A sociopath, a person who views others as mere objects, a psychopath who views others as mere objects and acts on it in a way that's destructive socially or personally. Although arguably most sociopaths end up ultimately becoming destructive. There are some very, very charming sociopaths who become good politicians or good salespeople or
you know,
whatever. But when they start eating people, they're psychopaths. But Milton, I'm with you, and in fact, this raises two really interesting questions or issues. One is that if you look at Aboriginal societies, and Peter Farb wrote a brilliant book that should be required reading by anybody who is even remotely interested in the history of culture and sociology and anthropology. It's called Man's Rise to Civilization. It's not in print anymore, but you can easily find used copies because Peter Farb died back, I think, about a decade ago, and the book came out in the 60s. And what he did was he identified 34 Native American communities around the United States or around North America where he was able to actually get enough information that he could piece together what their culture was like at first contact, when white people from Europe first contacted them. And these cultures and societies were so rich and diverse and frankly very different all across the United States. But one of the things that was common to all of them is that none of them had police forces. And that the common way that they treated people, they had basically two ways of treating crimes. The first was you try to heal the person. You try to bring the person back into the society. You sit in a circle with them. Everybody shares their stories about how they had the same kind of challenges. You try to break through. You try to work it through with them and redeem them. And then secondly, if the person is defined as irredeemable, then they're outcast. They're literally cast out of the society. And for most people for many people in many parts of the United States, that meant that, you know, within a few weeks they'd be dead. Because without a society, it's very, very difficult to live. Or groups of them would become wanderers, and that's where the phrase renegade came from.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah. And if you look, I think it's mostly on the Pacific Northwest where people are practicing it now, and I think it's mostly indigenous people practicing restorative justice.
Yes.
Restorative justice is about making amends, but the amends isn't to fix what you did. The amends is to make yourself able to rejoin your community.
That's right. To heal yourself, to fix yourself, or to fix the injured person. You're absolutely right. There's another brilliant book about this called Dancing with a Ghost by a Canadian attorney. I read it almost 20 years ago. I'm sorry, I can't remember the author's name, but it was absolutely brilliant. Milton, thanks a lot for the call and for the thought-provoking conversation. Thanks for listening to WHMP.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, you know, we've been having this debate since the 16th century, the 17th century. Is man evil or good? It's still the conservative versus liberal debate. Music is still there. I forgot to turn my volume up. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. Okay, is evil real? And how do we deal with it? And as I was saying earlier, this is the foundational debate between conservatives and liberals. Most people don't realize this. Say, well, what's the difference between a conservative and a liberal? Or a conservative and a progressive? Conservatives believe that humans are fundamentally evil. And therefore, you have to have strong leaders and followers need to fall into line. You have to have hierarchy. Somebody's got to be in charge. Liberals believe that conservatives believe that you have to have this because people are fundamentally evil. And if somebody who's good because they overcame their evil somehow, isn't in charge, then society will go to hell and it'll fall apart. Liberals believe that people are fundamentally good, that evil is an aberration. And because we are fundamentally good, we can all decide on who's going to be our representatives in government. And those people will, because they are fundamentally good, also do what's in our best interest. Now, the corruption of politics by money adds an interesting twist to this. But I would submit to you that people like George Washington, who called himself a liberal, and Thomas Jefferson, who called himself a liberal, and others, in fact, George Washington said, I hope I shall ever see America in the forefront of liberality, that those people, if they were to look at what's going on today with the corruption of our politics by money, would say, this is not the country that we intended to found. So we have that. And then in our first hour, we were talking about Mitt Romney. I got this interesting note from a Jewish fellow who took offense at Mitt Romney. He said, did I get this right? That Mitt Romney said that Israel is successful because Jews are good businessmen? He said, your culture is successful? That Dan Senior wrote a book about that? I mean, isn't that kind of the basis of one of the anti-Semitic riffs on, you know, is that really what Mitt Romney was trying to say when he said it's your culture? I don't know. I can't look inside Mitt Romney's head. Chuck in Winterport, Maine. Hey, Chuck, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I'll try to keep this short. I would like to take evil out of this. I'm neither a physician nor an attorney, but evil to me is a religious term.
Generally?
It shows up neither in religion nor in medicine.
You mean neither in psychiatry or medicine?
Yeah. Psychiatry or medicine.
Yeah.
As an example, my father was born in 1908, and I was later to find out that he was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And the DSM at first had, or law originally had him as a homosexuality is a crime.
Right.
Then it became an illness.
Right.
And now I don't know what it is, but at any rate, it keeps changing.
Right. And you know, the Family Research Council would tell you that it's evil.
Well,
and you know, any kind of intelligent American would tell you that it's, you know, a difference like being left-handed.
Well, yeah. Another example is I've heard that somebody who's looked at these major executives of these huge corporations has analyzed these people and says they qualify for sociopathy.
Which people are you talking about?
The heads of these huge firms.
Oh, there was a whole article about that in Forbes or Fortune just
right. Six,
8 months ago about how the sociopaths were ideally suited to become CEOs and sociopaths were overrepresented in corporate boardrooms and particularly on Wall Street. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. And
there is a point
where sociopathy becomes so terrible. You know, where you've got John Wayne Gacy killing people and burying them in his basement. The guy in Colorado, you know, killing all these people.
Right.
Where we almost lack a word. And at that point, I think evil, for lack of anything else, is it mental illness or is it a defect? I mean, it's certainly not a deviation from the norm. It is something way beyond that. So, Chuck, we got, you know, this is a real struggle. I think that all of us, you know, really need to be considering this. Thanks a lot, Chuck, for the call. Liz in Valley Glen, California. Hey, Liz.
Hi, good morning, Tom. The first person who called, the first caller after your last guest, kind of said it all for me, but I had worked in social services for 5 years and then went to work in the court system. And I ended up working in civil rather than criminal because, and you'll have to excuse the expression, I'm going to commit a Mitt Romney here. I didn't want to work with those people anymore.
Yeah.
And I find the problem is, you know, if you really want to resolve things, you really need to have more social programs. If you took the money out of the prison systems and put it in programs to help people, one of my coworkers worked in the drug court. They instituted something out here in California where they had an option. And they had a place called the drug court, and they could go in and either get rehabilitation or go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys who came back in would, one after another, say, thank the judge profusely. Thank you. You've given me my life back. You've helped me. Finally, there was a program that helped these people.
Right.
And I think, you know, even working in civil, I see how people are, like, with children. I think, forget about licensing marriage. License people to have children. I know that's a little extreme, but I think, you know, like, even all these drugs that have come in, legalize them all.
Mm-hmm.
And take the money that you would spend in the justice system to help the people who want to stop using.
That's what Portugal did, and they've been very, very successful. They saw that not only when they decriminalized all drugs, including heroin, not only did they see the use of drugs drop, they broke the back of organized crime, and now they're seeing levels of drug addiction slowly going down because people are getting treatment they need rather than being put in jail. So your point is well taken, Liz. Thank you very much. You set up brilliantly. Amanda in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Amanda.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I have a background in political science and religious studies, but that aside, I think as a society, we have to believe in the goodness of people, not in the evil of people. We have to believe that you've come into the world as a blank slate and, you know, society writes upon you. Without that, we end up in a place of racism and hatred, you know, looking at people's forehead sizes to see if they measure large enough.
Right.
To fit for a eugenics program. It's a very slippery slope to believe in the innate evil of humanity.
But this is the belief in the innate evil of humanity was at the core of everything from the British Empire to the notion to this day. It's on the British coins in Latin, you know, the queen rules by the grace of God. From that to Saddam Hussein's Iraq. It's always been the rationale of dictators. It's always been the rationale of kings. It's always been the rationale of theocrats. It was the basis upon which the Catholic Church not only ruled Europe but conquered much of the rest of the world. You know,
absolutely.
And I would submit to you that Hobbes was wrong, that Locke and Rousseau and Jefferson were right. But, you know, when Jefferson was arguing that people are fundamentally good and therefore able to govern themselves, there were a lot of people in the early republic, Alexander Hamilton, John Adams, very prominent people who are arguing against Jefferson and Paine, saying, no, you can't trust the people. You know, John Adams famously called people like you and me the rabble. He said, you know, you can't trust the rabble. You have to have a natural aristocracy. In other words, the gifted people, the people who are, you know, you could put it in a religious context, and say that they are blessed by God, or you could put it in a biological context and say that they're smart or whatever. But, you know, they're not the rabble. They are the elite of society. Jefferson would have nothing to do with that. He was horrified by the idea, as were most of the Enlightenment thinkers. But there were a lot of people in that day who still bought into the old British notion that was the basis of the British Empire, that if you don't rule with an iron fist, then all hell's going to break loose.
And I think what you see is that even today, the elite and the church are the ones who feel most threatened by the idea that people are good, and perhaps for different reasons. But that's why your idea of, you know, liberalism believing in the natural good of people and conservative believing in the natural evil just hits the nail on the head.
Yep.
From completely different places.
Yeah, and let me toss in libertarianism in here, because there's a lot of libertarians who are asserting that they think that freedom, everything should be free because people are good. But really what they're asserting is that there should be basically no rules to society, that we don't have a society, that we're all just lone individuals, and that whoever the biggest predator is, whoever climbs to the top of the heap, whoever is the most willing to crush others will end up in charge. And that's that idea of a natural aristocracy, of a Darwinian aristocracy. Charles Galton, I think was his name, Darwin's cousin, who promoted the idea who was an economist, who promoted the idea that there was a natural aristocracy and they should rule economically. And I would submit that libertarians are simply conservatives who don't realize that they're conservatives, because they're fundamentally believing that most people are evil and there's going to be a few people who rise above everything else, and they're the good ones and they should run everything and end up.
Well, that's why I like that idea of sort of we come to the world as a blank slate. You know,
yeah.
You certainly have a responsibility for yourself, but we have a responsibility for one another.
Yes.
And, you know, if society will, you know, views one another as blank slates that we can sort of affect, we can write on the slate of other people, then not only do you have to take responsibility for yourself and who you are, but you have to take responsibility for the people that you come into contact
yep.
every day. You
yep.
can change
what
who
was,
they are.
What was Cain's famous question to God? He said, am I my brother's keeper? And God basically said, yeah. Amanda, not that I'm trying to be a theologian, but Amanda, thank you for that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
My point with that, you know, going to the Bible, the Old Testament, was that this idea of are humans good or bad has been is a long time around. It's an old, old idea.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
I don't know. Do we have good news, bad news, medium news? Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria. Great to
hi.
See you. And hey, hi. So what's going on in the world today?
Well, we've got a combination of news. We
okay.
have some good news and we have some not so good news.
Yeah.
So we've got some news that's pending. And we'll start with the Mitt Romney news. So.
Okay.
Mitt Romney's hand of providence comment in Israel outraged Palestinians. Mitt Romney was at a fundraiser this morning at the King David Hotel, in which he said that the Jewish state's economic success compared with its Palestinian neighbors was due to cultural differences and the hand of providence.
Now, I have two questions about that. A,
yeah.
the obvious one that the Palestinians are talking about is, does the hand of providence mean God loves the Israelis and not the Palestinians? And B, does cultural differences mean the old anti-Semitic canard that Jews are better business people?
Well, it hasn't been explained by anybody, you see. He talked about the difference in GDP, which he got wrong.
Yes.
Even though he said that he'd read books on how on what made countries successful.
Yeah, he's probably reading Thomas Friedman if he got it wrong. Anyway.
No, he didn't mention Thomas Friedman, actually.
Okay.
But he said, I'm overwhelmingly impressed with the hand of providence whenever it chooses to apply itself. And he went on about various other things. But he did talk about Jerusalem being the capital of Israel. But he talked about cultural differences, and he talked about various other things, but he never spelt it out. Now, of course, the Palestinians said it seems that this man lacks information, knowledge, vision, and understanding of the region and its people. He said he also lacks knowledge about the Israelis themselves. He said, I've not heard any Israeli official speak about cultural superiority. This is a senior Palestinian official, Saeb Erekat.
Right.
Which I think is actually a valid point. I've not heard any Palestinian official saying that. Romney,
you mean Israeli official?
Israeli yeah. official. Romney didn't mention Israel's 45-year occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem. He didn't mention the blockade of Gaza either.
Right. One of the things he did say, though, is, and I'm quoting here, he said, one, I recognize the hand of providence in selecting this place. I was in a Sunday school class. I think my son Tag was teaching the class. He taught a class in which he was describing the concern on the part of some of the Jews who left Egypt to come to the Promised Land, and that the Promised Land was down from the Nile River. That would provide the essential water that they had enjoyed in Egypt. They came here recognizing that they must be relied upon themselves and the arm of God to provide rain from the sky. It seemed to me, reading that and knowing Mitt Romney's family history, that his family was one of the original settlers of Salt Lake City with Brigham Young, who literally went from the lush lands of the Midwest, where Joseph Smith was murdered, all the way to the deserts of Salt Lake, that he might have been trying to compare Mormons to the ancient Hebrews, to 3,000 years ago or more.
Well, he might have been. He might have been. But
has anybody raised that question of his campaign?
Not heard it. Not
yeah.
heard it raised.
Because, I mean, he put it in the context of a Bible class that he was in a Mormon, church.
It would take quite a lot of courage to raise that question with the campaign if you're traveling with him, if you don't want to get frozen out.
Which highlights one of the problems with the modern traveling with them press corps.
Exactly.
Yeah. Although one of the reporters today said that she felt like she was in a petting zoo because they had to sit in the bus and wave at the tourists, but they weren't allowed to talk to Mitt Romney. Was that Dana Perino? No, it wasn't Dana Perino. Who was it who said that?
I don't know who said that. How interesting.
Okay. Yeah, I saw it over at TPM. It was, in fact, I think it was a Fox reporter.
Oh, I'll have to look that up. Well, Fox reporters themselves are reporters.
Yeah, actually.
They are.
Strangely enough.
Don't forget, I'm a fan of Ben Hendrick.
It was Greta Van Susteren who said it.
Interesting.
She said, I feel like I'm in a modified petting zoo.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
But he made the statement, I recognize the power of at least culture and a few other things.
Right.
I don't know what that... It's all odd. Anyway, he's moved on from that gaffe to Poland now.
Oh, no. Where in Poland, he got Lech Walesa to say something nice about him. We hope you succeed, sir. And what Lech Walesa's union, Solidarity, immediately said, no, we don't.
That's exactly right.
We disavow these statements. We're with the AFL-CIO. We like Obama.
That's exactly what they've said. I wish to express on behalf of the president of Solidarność, solidarity with American workers and trade unions. Solidarność will always support the AFL-CIO in their struggle for the rights of workers to organize and bargain collectively. Ouch.
Yeah. Now, I'm seeing a headline over at TPM that says House Dems to force a vote on middle-income Bush tax cuts. House Democrats are going to put Republicans on record this week voting down an extension of the middle-income Bush tax cuts. Can they do that? I thought that the Republicans controlled the legislative agenda.
I would be very surprised if they can force it in the House unless they've come up with some fiendish way of doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of what fiendish method they've got in the House.
I don't know.
I'm not familiar enough with their fiendish ways.
It says on Monday, Ways and Means ranking member Sander Levin, Democrat from Michigan, will introduce legislation mirroring a Senate bill. We should take it up. We're going to introduce it, Levin. A floor vote is expected Thursday.
Huh. Well, good luck with that then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
We know where it's going to go. It's going to go right in the wastebasket.
It won't go very far. Like the following piece of legislation introduced today by Senator Frank Lautenberg and Representative Carolyn McCarthy, both Democrats. This is the bill to ban online ammunition sales in the wake of the Colorado movie theater shooting.
Hmm.
The bill would prohibit ammunition sales from anyone but licensed firearm dealers and require ammo buyers to present photo IDs before each purchase, effectively ending the practice of online sales. The proposal would also require dealers to report bulk ammunition purchases of more than 1,000 rounds.
Now, the NRA is part of ALEC, and ALEC passed all these laws that say you have to show photo ID to vote, but they don't want you to have to show photo ID to buy ammo?
Oh, well, come on now, Tom.
Okay, I'm sorry. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Great talking with you, Victoria, as always.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Okay, we've talked about Mitt Romney. We've talked about evil. Not an intentional juxtaposition, genuinely. But from evil to the conversation about guns and even a conversation about the Supreme Court, that I think is a reasonable juxtaposition. I get it. Americans want to have their guns, right? I understand a lot of the arguments in favor of gun ownership. You can build a case, and one that I will not refute, that someone should have the right to own a gun and or carry a gun, provided that they can demonstrate that they're proficient and competent and not crazy to protect themselves or their family. You could build a case that someone should have the right to own a gun to go hunting. You can build a case that someone should have the right to have a gun for competitive shooting. Like, I don't know if you've seen the picture floating around there about our show's senior executive producer, Louise Hartman, firing a .22 target pistol. You could build a case that someone has a right to a gun if they're in the business of protecting the nation, like the National Guard or the Reserves. In fact, that last one, that last on that list, was the real original reason the Founding Fathers wrote the Second Amendment. It was to protect the nation. Rewind back to the early days of America. Even after the British were beaten back in the Revolutionary War, there was still tremendous fear that America was vulnerable to attack. Could be the Spanish coming up from Florida, or the French, or the British again coming down through Canada, which they eventually did. And most of our Founding Fathers also had an enormous fear of standing armies during times of peace. After all, thousands of years of history showed them that great nations that kept standing armies during times of peace were often taken down by those very armies in military coups. Jefferson wrote exhaustively about this. He even threatened to blow up the Constitutional Convention to make sure that the Constitution didn't get ratified if it didn't include a protection against standing armies. In 1787, he wrote a letter to his protege, the opposite of mentor, James Madison. James Madison was, in 1787, writing the Constitution. That was the year of the Constitutional Convention. Jefferson at that time was the U.S. envoy to France, so he was in Paris at the time. And he was kind of micromanaging the Constitutional Convention from afar. And he wrote this, and Madison had sent him a first draft of the Constitution, and Jefferson sends him back a letter saying, "I do not like in the new federal constitution the omission of a Bill of Rights providing clearly protection against standing armies." In 1814, Jefferson wrote, "The Greeks and Romans had no standing armies, yet they defended themselves. Their system was to make every man a soldier and oblige him to repair to the standard of his country whenever that was reared. This made them invincible, and the same remedy will make us so." Right, so here's Jefferson calling for a national conscription, everybody a member of the local militia. And that's why they formulated the Second Amendment, which would provide for a well-regulated and well-armed militia that could be called on should the nation be under attack from without. Again, the Second Amendment is there to protect the government, to protect us, for us to protect ourselves. Our government is us, to the extent the Koch brothers don't completely own it. But recently, especially since President Obama took office, that rationale has been flipped on its head, and many, particularly on the right, are starting to talk like the Second Amendment is there to protect the people, you and me, against our own government. As if a militia in South Dakota, armed with rifles, handguns, and shotguns, could somehow beat back the U.S. Army, you know, with cruise missiles, tanks, and drones. They can't. This idea that the Second Amendment is a protection against tyranny from our own government is a canard. In fact, it's worse. It's a lie. A lie that's increasingly used today to paint President Obama as a radical who wants to take away our freedoms. But leave it up to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia to give credence to this outrageous and, frankly, dangerous belief that we got to have guns to protect ourselves from Obama. If the Second Amendment was really there to protect the people from their own government, then we'd have to have more than just handguns, right? We'd have to have heavy-duty weaponry, like, for example, a shoulder-fired rocket launcher.
Amendment does not apply to arms that cannot be hand-carried. It's to keep and bear, so it doesn't apply to cannons. But I suppose there are handheld rocket launchers that can bring down airplanes that will have to be, it'll have to be decided.
There you go. Yes, that was Justice Antonin Scalia suggesting that handheld rocket launchers might be constitutional under the Second Amendment. And what's his brilliant argument to justify this? Listen again.
The amendment does not apply to arms that cannot be hand-carried. It's to keep and bear, so it doesn't apply to cannons.
Did you catch that? Scalia is making the argument that since the Founding Fathers specifically said the right to bear arms, then any weapon that can be carried in someone's hands is good to go. It's unclear if the same logic applies to remote control for a weapon, like a drone, since anyone can bear a joystick, right? Or if it applies to nuclear weapons, since anyone can bear a triggering mechanism, or maybe just nuclear weapons that you know, could be fired from your shoulder. They're in development. Trust me. Tactical nuclear weapons. This is the sort of wacky logic that comes from Scalia whenever he clings to this originalist argument of the Constitution. It's his argument that the Constitution is dead. It's not living and breathing to adapt to a changing nation. It should be interpreted based solely on the words the Founding Fathers wrote at the time. And only Scalia knows what was in their heads. So in the debate over gun control, Scalia doesn't care about new weapon technology that our Founding Fathers couldn't have dreamed of, or mass shootings that would have sickened the Founding Fathers today. He only cares about the words, and in particular the word bear. Seems silly, especially since, you know, for all Scalia knows, Founding Fathers meant, or maybe not, that we should have the right to bear arms. As in the arms of bears. You think? There's an originalist argument for you, Justice Scalia. But jokes aside, this is a serious debate. Literally life and death. And for a Supreme Court justice like Antonin Scalia to say this issue is settled because of one word used by our Founding Fathers, the word bear. Look out, I'm going to hit you with this bear arm. It's not just irresponsible and intellectually lazy. It's dangerous. Saying that Americans should have the right to a handheld rocket launcher that can take down an airplane, that does serve a purpose that Scalia knows about. And that purpose is to add more legitimacy to those who believe that the Second Amendment was written to protect, for us to protect ourselves from our own government. And thus the people should be just as well armed as their government. That is not what our Founding Fathers intended. The Second Amendment is there to protect our government from foreign invaders, not from President Obama, who's just trying to give you health care. And if you think it's bad that we have a Supreme Court justice who doesn't understand that, I mean, just think about this for a minute. If you think it's bad that Antonin Scalia doesn't understand the plain language of the correspondences between Jefferson and Madison and all these, it's all there. Just think how many more wacko Supreme Court justices we'll have if Mitt Romney wins the White House. Mitt Romney, who has said his template for a Supreme Court justice is Antonin Scalia. Right. A guy who goes duck hunting with a criminal, or a guy who's accused of a crime, and then sits in judgment of that criminal a couple of weeks later and lets him off. In this case, Dick Cheney. Really? That's your idea of a brilliant Supreme Court justice? Scalia, by the way, in that conversation, he also said, you know, I don't criticize the president because he doesn't criticize me, right? In other words, he's saying he's a god of some kind. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, actually, I've got to tell you what Scalia said about his own position and why he thinks he's so powerful. Right after this. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And by the way, I have talked fondly and often about Jack Vance and his science fiction writings. And somebody called once and said, in fact, actually, there was a conversation in the chat room. This is some months ago. I said Jack Vance wrote me into one of his books. Jack is one of my heroes and a friend. And he's in his 90s now and just a brilliant, brilliant man and an incredible musician. And in my opinion, one of the very best writers of the 20th century and the 21st century. And I just have to read to you the first paragraph of the preface of his book, Ports of Call, which came out just a few years back. Ports of Call by Jack Vance. During the first expansion of the Guyan Reach, whenever adventurous youth yearned to become a locator, thousands of worlds in remote places had been explored. The most benign of these worlds attracted immigrants. There seemed to be no end to sects, factions, societies, cults, or simple groups of free thinkers who fared bravely off as pioneers to live their lives in the worlds of their own. Sometimes they survived or even prospered. Often more, the alien environment defeated the Gaian soul. The settlements decayed, the folk departed, sometimes leaving behind odd little clots of humanity, which by one means or another came to terms with their surroundings. Some of these worlds, seldom visited and remote from public notice, provided substance for Tom Hartman's haunting work, Lost Worlds and Forgotten People. Isn't that cool? To have your favorite author write you as an anthropologist 20,000 years in the future into his novel. If you haven't read Jack Vance's books, if you don't know Jack Vance, if you've ever enjoyed good literature and science fiction, check it out. And if you're one of those people who edits Wikipedia pages, just a tip. Anyway, Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. First of all, I sent you an email that bounced back. Is it tom@tomhartman.com?
It is, although I've got a really, really intense spam filter. I get between 500 and 700 emails a day. And so.
PHOM, Tom?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I didn't send you any spam.
Okay.
It's just an email.
Okay.
Okay. I wanted to talk about what you were talking about, the founders and their take on the Second Amendment. And it struck me that it's as instructive as the Federalist Papers are in talking about this issue, the Anti-Federalist Papers are equally instructive. Mm-hmm. In other words, neither side argued for what the gun nuts are arguing for now.
You're right. And the Anti-Federalists were what ultimately became the Democratic Republicans, the modern Democratic Party. Although at that time, at the time of the Federalist Papers, Jefferson probably would have described himself as a Federalist. Within 7 years, he had completely changed.
If in Federalist 23, Hamilton, and this is what I'm thinking of, Hamilton argues that the federal government should be able to tax you to the hilt in order to fund the standing army.
Right.
But the response to that was, well, if that's what you're going, and I don't know if it was the federal farmer, I can't remember which of the anti-federalists, the response to that was, well, if you're going to do that, then how are we going to be able to tax our own citizens so that we can have our own state militias if you take up all of our money? They weren't expecting that people were going to bring their own guns to be part of the militias. They were going to tax the people of the state so that they could equip them and train them.
Right.
It had nothing to do with whether or not there any. So neither side argued for this. And I don't think either side ever envisioned that this sort of thing of people shooting up the town would be a sort of an unavoidable natural consequence of the right to bear arms.
No, not even close to it. And for people who don't know what we're talking about, the Federalist Papers, 1787 was the Constitutional Convention. They wrote the Constitution. It took them 2 years to sell it to the American people. They had to get it ratified by the states. During those 2 years, principally, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, although John Jay and George Mason wrote a couple of them, as I recall, wrote under the name of Publius. They used a pseudonym. They wrote anonymously these letters to the editor of the newspaper that today we call in aggregate the Federalist Papers. And it was a sales pitch for the Constitution. And then there were people who felt that the Constitution was overly aggressive, that we really should continue operating under the Articles of Confederation, or we should modify the Articles of Confederation, that every state should basically be its own nation rather than a state within a nation. And stop me if I'm mischaracterizing the Anti-Federalists.
No, I think that's correct.
And so you had this group called the Anti-Federalists who were just as patriotic as the Federalists, who just as much believed in America as the Federalists did, who had fought side by side with the Federalists against the British. These were not Tories. These were not conservatives. These were modern American liberals who called themselves that, who were believers in the Enlightenment. They simply felt that in the debate about should we have strong federal government and weak states, or strong states and no federal government, basically a coalition, sort of like the Euro is right now, the European Union, they thought we should be more like the European Union, and they lost the argument. But neither the Federalists nor the Anti-Federalists, in their wildest imaginations, would have suggested that people should have guns to shoot at the government that they had just fought and died to create.
Well, the Anti-Federalists essentially didn't have a better suggestion. But one thing I wanted to mention about the Bill of Rights,
yeah.
Madison never wanted the Bill of Rights for two reasons. One thing, he didn't want the, did not write, want rights enumerated because he thought that future generations would mistakenly believe that those were the only rights that you have.
And in fact, he wrote a letter to Jefferson that said virtually that and virtually those words, yes.
And he also didn't want them enumerated in such a way that they stood out so that they would be misinterpreted.
Yes, yes.
Which they are now.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And Jefferson won that argument ultimately, and Madison ended up supporting the Bill of Rights in 1790, what was it, 3 or 1791, whenever they were ratified. It was a few years later. But initially he was very opposed to it, as was Hamilton. And you know, that made its way into the Federalist Papers, in fact. There's a whole argument against the Bill of Rights in the Federalist Papers. So, Paul, brilliant, brilliant. I got the smartest listeners on earth. Thanks for listening to Talk 1090 in Washington State there in Seattle. We'll talk again. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And has anybody heard from Mitt Romney? You know, which country is he going to screw up next? He's in Poland right now. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very predatoriously ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, EcoWine.com. The good, the Democratic National Committee. Yesterday, the DNC officially put language into its party platform that endorses marriage equality and calls for the full repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act. While President Obama has already come out in favor of marriage equality, the fact that it is now an official part of the Democratic Party platform, a very big deal. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like the Republican National Committee is going to be following in the Democrats' footsteps anytime soon. Marriage equality should be a basic human right in America. Kudos to the DNC for recognizing this and giving a huge lift to the gay community. The bad. The Ralph Smead Foundation. A libertarian group is sponsoring a billboard in Idaho that compares President Obama to the shooter in Colorado. The billboard reads, "Kills 12 in a movie theater with assault rifle, everyone freaks out. Kills thousands with foreign policy, wins Nobel Prize." The tragedy in Colorado occurred less than 2 weeks ago, but the Smead Foundation decided to ignore the still fresh physical and mental wounds of the shooting in favor of promoting their political agenda. They've given new meaning to the words "too soon." And the very, very ugly, the First Baptist Church of Crystal Springs. Charles and Andrea Wilson had booked the church and distributed invitations for their wedding ceremony, which they expected to go off without a hitch. Instead, some members of the mostly white church in Mississippi banned the African-American couple from getting married in it and threatened to vote out the pastor of the church if he went ahead with the ceremony. It's 2012, but in some places in America, an African-American couple still can't get married without facing racial insensitivity and bigotry, and that is very, very ugly. That's incredible. Plus, they were members of the church. Or regular attendees, one or the other. Oh, amazing. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Troy in Minneapolis. Hey, Troy, what's in your mind?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Well, sure. I tell you, I'm just bursting with pride, you know, that those of us in the progressive liberal angle know, you know, really what's best for everybody, and we have an answer for every argument, you know, no matter, you know, what information is supplied on either side. You know, case in point, you know, you and Victoria just spoke a few minutes ago about how when the final...
Troy, your sarcasm is not making it. What is the actual argument that you're trying to make, rather than these kind of, you know, nonsense, the personal attacks?
I'm trying to say, when you and Victoria were speaking and extolling the virtues of the benefits of delegalizing drugs, and how wonderful that made everything. You know, it did away with all the problems with drugs in that particular country. But now, you know, we need to make sure that we vilify and that we ban, you know, weapons and ammunition, because that's going to solve our problems. So either ban all this or legalize.
So are you suggesting that people who are gun collectors and like to go shooting, like me and my wife and my brother, are mentally ill?
I didn't say that.
Well, you know, drug addiction is a mental illness. You'll find it, you know, in any, you know, in the DSM-4, you'll find it in any book. You know, drug addiction is a mental illness. If you're trying to equate the use of drugs with the use of guns, it seems like you're saying that gun owners are mentally ill. Is that your point?
No, that's not my point. In fact, you avoided my question entirely.
What was your question?
My question is how does legalizing something that's illegal make the problem go away?
It doesn't.
Exactly.
It doesn't make the problem go away. We had, you know, back in the 1700s, back in the 1800s, back in the 1900s, back in the early 2000s, in the first part of the 20th century, before we criminalized drugs, you had people who were overusing or abusing Lydia Pinkham's tonic or tincture of opium, or for that matter, Bear and Company in either 1919 or 1929, I think it was 1919, rolled out a new cough syrup for children. The brand name was heroin. There were people who were using and abusing those drugs during all that time. Alcohol is the most widely used and abused drug in the United States. It causes 50,000 deaths a year. It kills more people than guns do and cars do. That doesn't mean that you make it illegal. And it doesn't mean you put people in prison for having the mental illness or whatever you want to call it of being addicted to it. It means you treat them as people who have a medical problem. And that's what we need to be doing with drugs. Now, if you want to suggest that we should be treating people who like to play with guns as having a mental problem, I would disagree with you.
Oh, I don't think that at all. In fact, I believe in the right to bear arms. I don't have an issue with that. My point was that you were, praising whatever that country was that
Portugal. Portugal decriminalized drugs. You've got five countries in South America, by the way, that will probably do the same within the next year or two. Portugal decriminalized all drugs. The Netherlands, for years, has decriminalized soft drugs, pot in particular, and some psychedelics, mushrooms, largely mushrooms, some peyote. And now they've had to make it so that it's you actually have to show ID proving that you're a Dutch citizen to buy pot in the pot stores. But, I remember sitting in a fancy restaurant with my wife and kids in for Christmas vacation back 5-6 years. Well, I was on 9/11. It was the week. It was the year after 9/11. The Christmas after. So 2002, and in Amsterdam, in the fancy restaurant right across the street from the big gambling house across the street from the Rijksmuseum. Nice 5-star, white linen tablecloth. And the guy comes over and he hands me the wine list and then he hands me the pot menu. And, I mean, to the extent that they have a problem with drugs in Holland, they deal with it as a medical issue. They don't have an organized crime problem as a consequence of that. We had on this program the chief of police of what's the main city in the Netherlands? I'm drawing a blank. Amsterdam. We had the chief of police Amsterdam on this show. And he was like, yeah, we don't have drug crime, because if you want to buy drugs, we got stores where you can walk in the door and say, yes, I'll take a half ounce of that, of Acapulco Gold, please. And, it worked for Holland. It's working for Portugal. It worked for the United States for 200 years. Prohibition of alcohol and prohibition of drugs were started at pretty much the same time. And we figured out really quickly that prohibition of alcohol was stupid, and we should have stopped the prohibition of drugs at the same time. Because, frankly, alcohol is one of the more destructive of the drugs.
Absolutely. And that's why if you ban something, what happens? The people, just banning it doesn't make it go away. In fact, banning it makes people want it more.
Well, especially if it's an addictive substance. If you're trying to draw a parallel between AK-47s or AR-15s and pot, again, I would suggest that you are trying to say that people who want to own guns are mentally ill. And I would submit to you that, to a certain extent, that's true in if they're going to go into a theater and kill people. And so, therefore, as a society, because typically people don't go into theaters and kill people by throwing pot at them, right? In fact, to the best of my knowledge, I've never heard of anybody killing people by throwing cocaine or heroin at them. But, they can kill people with an AR-15.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, the point is, bans don't work, whether it's drugs or guns or abortions. I mean, look at the mayor of New York. I mean, he wants to equate, he wants to get Similac away from mothers so they can only use breast milk. So, let's see, abortion is safer for a baby than Similac. It's insane.
Do you think, Troy, that there are people who, if they had the easy ability to buy the equipment to make it happen, that would be, the shoulder-fired rifle that Scalia was saying should be constitutional because, after all, it's an arm you can bear, that they would do so and we would have airplanes being shot out of the sky right now in the United States?
Yes, because because I'm sure there's mental illness. It's just like, you know, do people...
Okay, so then you are in favor of banning weapons that can cause mass destruction, right?
No, I'm in favor...
You're opposed to that.
I'm in favor of adhering to what's constitutionally in action right
Where
now.
In the Constitution does it mention weapons that are capable of rapid fire? The Gatling gun wasn't invented until the 1830s.
Well, if we can't have them, then why does the military have them? If it's illegal, it's illegal.
Because the military's job is to defend this country.
Correct.
And the Second Amendment says, I'm sure you probably know this from heart. What are the first five or six words of the Second Amendment?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought I knew it by heart, but I just want to make sure that I have it exactly right, so I will read it to you. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Easy, right?
I beg your pardon?
It's great. It's easy. I mean, it's perfectly legible and understandable.
Yeah, it's the entire thing. And what they're saying, and this was the debate that they were having back in the 1700s, late 1700s, after the Revolutionary War. And it was not a debate about should we arm up so that we can take down the government that we're all now putting together by ratifying the Constitution and that we fought and died for in the Revolutionary War. No. What they were saying was we should have every community should have a local militia under local control to protect themselves. It's the way Switzerland operates right now. It's the way Israel operates to some extent. It's the way a lot of countries around the world operate. It's been the Swiss model forever. And it was the model that Jefferson and Madison were pushing for, not to have a standing army except during times of war, but instead of a standing army to have all the people of the country be members, or all the men between the ages of 17 and 47, be members of a citizens' militia that was answerable to local elected authority. And that's why the Second Amendment is in the Constitution. And that's why it starts out, a well-regulated militia, the first four words of the Second Amendment. So, anyhow, good talking with you, Troy. Thanks for the call. Yeah, I understand your sarcasm and your attempt to, you know, try to poke, but, you know, it's much more fun, actually, just discussing the issues and getting right to the core of it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Hopefully fun for both of us, in fact, because I think you called up to disagree with me, and I think it seemed like we ended up agreeing. We'll be right back. Democracy is coming. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back, William in Alexandria, Virginia. Hey, William, what's on your mind?
How you doing? I love your show. I do more listening than calling. That way I can learn more. But I did have a question. The gentleman you were just speaking with, and I've heard this discussion quite a bit when people quote the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. My question is, in quoting the Second Amendment, how can one or two sentences or even a paragraph written so long ago, how can we apply it verbatim to modern day? What needs to be added? You see what I'm saying?
Sure. And I am looking for, maybe I don't have it. Rats. Oh. No. This is about education. I don't have it. I'm sorry. Somewhere around here, I have the Pennsylvania Constitution circa 1780.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Pennsylvania Constitution, it says, standing armies during time, I'm paraphrasing now because I can't read it to you verbatim.
Right.
But you can find it. Standing armies during times of peace are a known pernicious force in republics. In Republican government is how they used to refer to it. R. And therefore, there will be no standing army during times of peace in the state of Pennsylvania, but every able-bodied man between the ages of 17 and 47 shall be a member of a local militia. And in order that the well-regulated militias can protect the state of Pennsylvania, the right of the citizens to bear arms shall not be infringed or abridged. that was the original language or the original template for the original language for the Second Amendment. And as an earlier caller pointed out, you can go back and you can read the minutes, James Madison's minutes from the Constitutional Convention. You can read the correspondence between Madison and Jefferson. It's not hard to find on this issue. They sent back and forth four or five letters on the topic. You can read the conversations between Jefferson and Adams about this topic. You can read the debate between the Federalist Papers. It was in the 20s, 28, 29, something like that, where Hamilton was writing about the right to bear arms. And on the other hand, the Anti-Federalist Papers, the ones who didn't want us to have the Constitution, they wanted us to continue operating under the Articles of Confederation. They both wanted America to be America. Nobody wanted to go back to Great Britain. Nobody ever in any of those debates ever suggested that the reason why citizens should have the right to bear arms is to take out the government of the United States or to fight against the United States or to overthrow the United States. Never. The idea was always this is the most efficient way to accomplish two goals. One, to defend this nation against invasion, because at that time we had Spain on our southern border. They controlled Florida, and we had both France and England, and they ultimately did invade in 1812. And so, you know, it was how do we protect our country, number one. And number two, and perhaps more importantly, how do we prevent the military from rising up and taking over this beautiful government that we've just created? Because we've seen it over and over and over in the history of the world where a nation becomes a power. The power goes to the military. The military ends up running the nation. You're seeing it in Egypt right now. And right. That's what they wanted to avoid. And so the theory was no standing army during time of peace and have a citizen-based militia. And that no standing army during time of peace, Jefferson actually threatened to blow up the Constitution twice in 1787 over the fact that it wasn't in the Bill of Rights. He ended up backing down for the greater good. He thought, you know, the Constitution was flawed, but, you know, what the heck. And when he was president, when he became president, there were over 300,000 men under arms in the United States. And by the time he left, that was in 1800. When he left in 1808, we were down to around 4,000, a little less than 4,000. He was closing military bases like there was no tomorrow. And reducing the size of the army and trying to build citizens' militias. But he wasn't able to do it as president. And then the War of 1812 happened a couple of years after he left when James Madison was president. And we've basically been on a military kick ever since. But
do you feel that something said and written in 1780 could apply to a situation that was never thought to exist when it was written?
You mean like automatic weapons?
You and I could go even further than that, but we can start with that for the essence
sure.
of time.
I would suggest to you that the answer is probably no, and this is where I disagree with Scalia. Scalia thinks the right to bear arms should include, you know, shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles that could take out airplanes. I don't. Back in the day, back in the 1780s, they were talking about flintlocks. But they were talking about citizens' militias to protect the government, to protect our government, for us to protect ourselves. That the government, up until Ronald Reagan, people thought of the government as a good thing. You know, it's like,
you're right.
And up until the Obama presidency, people pitched the right to bear arms as the right to self-defense. It wasn't until Obama was president that these right-wing, and I would add probably largely racist, whether they realize it or not, wackos started talking about we've got to protect ourselves against the government or against Obama, you know, against tyranny that's coming. And before that, it was, you know, look out for the carjackers. Therefore, you got to have a gun. But I think that it is possible to say that there are some things that were true in 1787 that are still true today. And one of those is that when the military gets too big and too strong, it represents a threat to small d democracy and a small r republic.
I agree. But this is the reason my question was because this Second Amendment being used to represent something that it really should not be. And that's my opinion. I agree. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Have a great week.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the call, William. Great to hear from you. And I think you nailed it. And as I said, the Second Amendment was there so we the people could more effectively protect and defend ourselves and our own country. And not ourselves as individuals, but as a nation. The founders and framers were very all about we're in it all together. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, with taxing the Internet help or hurt the economy or the Internet for that matter? Is it taxation without representation? I'll have a I'll challenge the folks at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Plus, we'll have the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. A republic starts when you show up. Get out there, get active, occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.